I don't know if you had Canadian history. I remember going to school and figuring I had Canadian history every year we went. And I came across some Canadian history this week that I haven't read before. 1750s, there was the fighting between the British and the French. You remember that? British coming out of Nova Scotia, French having Quebec, and each wanting Canada. And so the fighting was happening. They would get the various native tribes to join them on both sides, and sometimes it was incredibly vicious fighting. Battles would kind of come and kind of go. In the 1750s, though, the British decided that they were going to attack Quebec. And they were going to attack Quebec City specifically. And so they arranged for a group of soldiers, a land force to march up and attack Quebec itself, the city itself. But to make it even better, they decided to send several of their ships up the St. Lawrence Seaway and park themselves right out in front of Quebec and with their guns start to blow the city apart with their cannons. Well, they enlisted an Admiral Phipps, commander of the British force. Doesn't that sound British? Admiral Phipps, and he set sail when the land troops started to march out, and surprisingly, he got there several days before the battle was to take place. So he parked his ships outside in the bay, and everything was locked down in the city, You have to understand the British were Church of England. We would call them Anglicans, very, very committed, very anti-Catholics. And of course the French were Catholics. And so as he sat in his ship waiting for the land troops to march in and start the battle, he was sitting in his boat looking over to the city of Quebec. And he saw the Quebec Cathedral there. And it really started to bug him because he started to see all of these statues that they had built around the cathedral and on top of the cathedral of various saints. And he didn't believe in the saints, and he didn't like this papacy stuff that was going on, and he just got madder and madder. And so one day, as he was still waiting, he decided, you know what, while we're waiting, we're going to knock down some of those saints. And so he got his cannons out and everything lined up, and he commissioned his men to start shooting the saints down, the statues of the saints. And the cannons started to roar and shot this way. Ah, I just missed him. Shot that one. Just missed him. Try again. And they kept shooting and kept shooting for who knows how long until he ran out of cannonballs and ammunition. Just then, the British forces marched in, ready for him to start his barrage of cannons into the Quebec City, and they went to attack, and he sat there with nothing left to shoot. I was thinking about that story. It's kind of funny, but it's almost this man's anger. He could not control himself, couldn't stop himself from doing this silly little thing that eventually literally cost them to lose the battle. We've been going through the book of Luke, and if you've been traveling with us, reading with us, and by the way, we're challenging you all to read the book of Luke three times. We're running into passages and areas that are sometimes found in Mark and Matthew, but not always. In fact, there's huge parts that we've come across already that are distinct. As we enter chapter 11, though, there's some stuff we know and some new stuff. Let me give you, if you haven't been with us, an understanding of the setting, because a couple of things have changed. Jesus, in Luke's gospel, focused the first number of years, 1.5 to 2 years in Galilee, and now he is making a journey down to Jerusalem. When he arrives at Jerusalem, finally, permanently, he'll be arrested and he'll be crucified. He knows that. He's already announced that will take place. And yet, in obedience and in love for you and I, he's headed for the cross. As they leave Galilee and start to minister in Samaria and Perea and down even into Judea, crowds, thousands and thousands of people are coming. In fact, it says by the time we get to chapter 12, they're stumbling over each other. There's this massive influx of people coming to hear Jesus and see Jesus and experience his miraculous power. At the same time, anger is appearing. Remember, this Captain Fitz got so angry he couldn't control himself? Well, the anger was through religious leaders. First, they tried to force him into their laws and their regulations and their standards and their practices, and he just refused. And so one day they're criticizing him because he's healing a man in a synagogue on the Sabbath, and they're not supposed to work on the Sabbath. And another day they're criticizing his disciples because they're walking through a field on the way to synagogue, and they just grab some grain and start to eat it, and they're working or harvesting on the Sabbath. And then they're after him because he doesn't fast like they're supposed to fast, and just the criticisms are coming here and there and all over the place. But there's nothing intentionally strategic. As we get to this chapter, that all changes. For an attack, a planned, a thought through attack starts to take place in Jesus' ministry. This will escalate and this will increase to the point of his arrest in the garden. Now, it seems like almost a minimal event took place. If you read the gospel, Jesus has, from the very beginning of his ministry, has been healing the sick. He has been casting out demons. He's shown examples of power over nature, both dividing fish and bread to feed thousands and to stopping the storm. He's even raised the dead. And so, on a normal day, he's just finished preaching on prayer and what you and I would call the Lord's Prayer and some really cool passages following that, and people then start to come to him and receive healing. A man comes and he's mute. Now you would think that's biological. You would think that's medical. But it wasn't. It was demonic. There was what was called a mute spirit in this man. And Jesus, it would seem, almost simply cast this spirit out, drives it away. And the man, it doesn't say it in this language, but a paraphrase may say, the man suddenly became a motorist. He just started talking. And everybody's like, wow, look at this guy. Jesus has done that. And people are absolutely amazed. As that takes place, though, the first attack starts to come on. Pharisees and Sadducees, scribes, keepers of the law, step up and they start to lay charges against Jesus. The charge is actually twofold and it focuses on Jesus' power. The first is a suggestion that where does this power come from? And they have suggested this power comes from Beelzebub or Satan. Otherwise, it's demonically inspired power that comes from the enemy of Israel, not the God of Israel. Now, even to use that name, the word Beelzebub isn't one that you and I constantly use. We often use Satan or Lucifer or other ones. But there was an implication to this, because it went all the way back into the Old Testament, all the way back to the Philistines, and they had a god they called Beelzebub. What's the suggestion? That Jesus is leaning in power on a pagan god who is full of idolatry and unclean. In fact, Beelzebub means Lord of the Flies. You may have heard that phrase before. And it's about a carcass that is rotting and smelling in the sun, and the flies are all the way. It's kind of a disgusting name. And they're saying, Jesus, you get your power from that. Now that's repeated in Matthew, that's repeated in Mark, and Luke as well. Now they didn't leave it there. They went on and they said, if you're not empowered by Satan, then what we want you to do is we want you to show you a sign. Now this question has been asked to him again and again and again and again. And you and I may say, well, of course, there were signs all over the place. He healed this man. He cured this leper. He raised this child. He's done all of the, but they don't want those things. They want a specific sign. They want a sign in the heavens, it says in both Matthew and Mark. They want a sign in the heaven. That God is using him. Now, what that even meant, I'm guessing they didn't even know. But they were asking him for something that they would control him or manipulate him. Now, I don't want you to miss this, and we talked about this in Bible study. I don't want you to miss the strategy and the brilliance of this test, this attack on who Jesus is. If you and I were to lay the ministry of Jesus out, we would start with his birth, a miraculous birth conceived through the Holy Spirit. We'd consider looking through the various claims that he is the Messiah, he is the anointed one, he has been called, predicted hundreds of years before with his coming, he was of the line of David. We could talk about his amazing teaching, and the people used to step back in awe saying, look at his power, look at the authority he teaches with. But all of that is confirmed by his power. Now, what happens if you start attacking that power? If you start to say that deliverance of the demonic comes from Satan, the healing of the sick comes from Satan, the casting, the controlling nature comes from Satan, suddenly all of these other areas are starting to be impacted. Well, if his power comes from Satan, maybe his teaching comes from Satan. Well, maybe his claim to be a Messiah comes from Satan. Maybe even his birth was a lie. And suddenly he's just a man. And suddenly people would start to leave him and abandon him. So this was a critical test. What's fascinating is Jesus' response. Because he looks at them and he answers in almost a Greek way. Now the Jewish men and women were brilliant, brilliant scholars. But the Greek had a logic to them, a way of thinking through things and all of that. And so he starts to explain to them this discussion. And they're starting. He looks at them and he says, what are you guys thinking? Have you even thought this through? And he started to say something right quite fascinating. He says, how can a house divided stand? It's the idea if a king is going to war against another king, and in his house there are different people attempting to steal the throne or creating civil war, how's this guy ever going to get his armies together to fight this one? Of course, this one is going to come and conquer them because this other one has been divided. And he gives this simple logic. If I'm casting out demons, driving back Satan's work, how can I be working for Satan? It just doesn't make any sense. There's no logic to it. It's interesting that in the 1800s, 1858, Abraham Lincoln used this verse in one of his speeches. I don't know if you know the whole story, but at that time, in the 1850s, there was this rising tension in the United States, especially as they were pushing westward. Because the North had very little slavery, almost no slavery, and highly was resisting slavery. The South lived and depended fully and completely on slavery. But as they started to move westward, these people started to take their slaves with them. And these people started to say, you can't take slaves out here. You can't have slaves here. And this debate and this tension started to rise. Abraham Lincoln would say, a house divided won't stand. You can't believe in slavery and oppose slavery. It's going to affect our nation. In 1861, a couple years later, he was made president. And within 1 month, the Civil War, the most devastating war the States has ever been in, happened, where many of its sons and children died in this incredibly violent war, because a house divided can't stand. And so Jesus looks at these disciples, these Pharisees, and he logically pulls it apart, and he says, you guys aren't even thinking. A house divided can't stand. I can't be working for the one I'm driving out. I am his enemy. And then he uses a separate picture. It's an interesting picture. It's a man in his house, and it's this, as if this man is going to be defending his house, and he has all of his armor on and all his helmet on, and he has a sword and he has a shield. And then a strong man breaks in, a bigger man with greater army and greater weapons, and literally defeats this demon and throws it out of the house and throws it into an arid place. Now, there's lots of lessons around this, but it's the idea that a strong man is the one who throws the weaker one out. How did Jesus throw the demonic out? Because he is the strong man. He is empowered by God. He is working on God's side. And so he looks at them, and they're kind of devastated. It's like we thought that was a really good attack. And Jesus kind of smiles at them and blinks. And he says, and then there's that other question you asked. That other question was give me a sign in heaven. Now, I came across this sign. I guess it's been posted all over North America. I think it's actually kind of funny. But did you ask for a sign? Sign God? There it is. But as he looked, Jesus looks at him, he looks around and he says an interesting thing. He says, you want a sign? I'll give you a sign. And he talks about the sign of Jonah and the whale. Now, I don't know if you remember the story of Jonah and the whale, but Jonah ran away out of God's will, was trying to escape God's will, and a storm came up in a boat, and they threw him over, and a whale swallowed him and took him literally back to the shores of when he climbed out of the whale, got out of the whale, then literally he walked up to Nineveh. But just as Jonah was in the whale, the symbol of death, for 3 days, Jesus would be in the grave for 3 days. And then just like Jonah came out and preached, Jesus would come out. Now, as you look at this story, you realize that the Pharisees had no idea what this meant. In fact, the disciples didn't even know what this meant, but they would when Jesus came out of the tomb. And so Jesus looks at them, and he's answered this question. But let me pause for a second, and help you and I think about this. I'm quite aware in our culture, in our world today, there's lots of debate going on. One of the comments you'll hear in churches and from ministers and from all kinds of situations is that you and I are in a spiritual battle. This was an attack. This was a battle against Jesus Christ, and he recognizes such and responded as such. I want to suggest to you that there are times in your spiritual journey, as you're living and walking, that you have to realize that the question you're given or the situation you're put in or the events that are surrounding you are designed as attacks on your faith or your integrity or your credibility as a Christian. So sometimes the enemy wants to test if you really truly believe in God and have faith in God and will trust God. Others, it's a question of, will I obey him? Will I follow him? Will I walk with him? The reality, though, is as I've been working through this, even in these last months, as I started to realize that there's some Christians who want to name everything as a spiritual attack. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's not a spiritual warfare at all. It's just life. And so there has to be a discerning spirit in us to say, is this a battle? And is this not a battle? And if this is a spiritual attack, how do I want to respond to it? I find this really interesting, the way Jesus responded to this attack. He could have just rebuked them. But that probably would not have worked well. Instead, he approached them with a clear, interesting logic. If this is true, this can't be true. And it defeated all of what they believed and did. Paul would hold up to this style as well. It would say that he would gather together and reason with them. Later on in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8, Peter would talk about Satan being a roaring lion to come and destroy us. And he would say, be sober. And then sometimes your translations will say alert. As you look at those two words, what they simply mean is you need to be someone who's aware of when a spiritual attack is coming on you and thoughtfully, reflectively, sometimes even logically, respond in a way that brings defeat on the enemy's argument. Are you aware that there are times that you are in spiritual conflict? Are you aware that God has given you the words and the ability to respond in a way that will defeat the enemy? In fact, later on, Paul says in Corinthians, he will tear down arguments. He will tear down pretenses because what God has in us is more powerful. So the battle is over. Jesus has won it and walked away. But the story's not done. Several days later, another event comes up. I don't know if any of you kayak. Some of you, I know, are gifted and even have gone out to the West Coast and have ocean kayaked. If you go around Victoria, there's some bays. And it'll be a narrow entry and then coming into it and be a full bay that you can bring your kayak into. But the thing that I remember when I first went and kayaked the ocean, the thing I was not used to was the tides. Because the tides would change everything. That you may come in and the tide's low, or you may come in when the tide's high. I remember us going into a bay, stopping for lunch at one point, and we pulled everything up onto the ground, totally onto the ground, and the guides with us started tying our kayaks up higher and higher. It's like, what are you doing? Like, why are you doing that? And then they said, you just watch what the tide does. And the tide started to come in, and suddenly all of those boats were floating. If you watch a tide, it will come in over a number of hours, and it'll come through that tight break, and then it'll fill that whole bay, and everything will go up. But then the tide goes down, and suddenly it's rushing out that, almost at rapid level, out those that channel. It's almost like that happened to Jesus. It's almost like they were coming and attacking him, and it was suddenly the tide's changing, and Jesus, for the first time, starts to fight back, starts to attack. So why would he do that? Pettiness. Not on Jesus' part, but on the Pharisees' part. One of the Pharisees invited him to lunch. And as he came in and started to sit down, this Pharisee was watching every move. And he looked at him and he says, you didn't wash your hands the way Pharisees are supposed to wash their hands. Have you ever had one of those friends who's always picking? No matter what you do, they're always finding another fault. They're finding another. It's like, you know, you didn't do this, and so you deal with that issue, and you think, okay, we're done, and then you turn around and pick in again. That's what was happening, and it's almost as if Jesus had enough. It's almost as if he looked at them and he says, okay, it's time for you guys to hear straight exactly what you need to do if you're going to enter God's kingdom. And I've got to expose your sin. Now, that's not an easy place to be. He's sitting in a Pharisee's house. He's sitting with the enemy surrounding him. The only guys on his side are probably the disciples, and we don't even know how many were there. Jesus looks at them, and he points, first of all, to the Pharisees. And he says three things about them. Now, let me make a comment here. As you listen to these charges, you will see Jesus has thought through them very clearly, worded them very specifically and has clear distinction between them. Sometimes you'll argue with a person, and when you put all your arguments together, they all sound like the same thing. Well, these were different. So Jesus looks at them, and he starts to say these words. He says, first of all, this is a charge I have against you. You major on the minors and ignore the majors. What was he talking about? These Pharisees were into legalism. And they were keeping all of these minor little insignificant laws. For instance, you're a Pharisee and you need some herbs for your meals. And so you go all the way to the market and you buy this little bag of herbs. And you come back and then you bring it into your house and you pour it all out on the counter. And you start taking a tenth off of it because you have to tithe the tenth of it. And then you put the rest back in the bag and you put the others in another bag and you're going to take it to the temple to tithe this little bit of mint or whatever. And Jesus says, you guys worry about all of these insignificant things of keeping this rule and that rule and this rule. And you ignore things like the love of God to people. You ignore or neglect injustices or things that are done against your brothers and sisters in the faith. How do you major on all of these minor things but ignore these things that God says counts? I know it was a charge. Is your life focused on the majors or the minors? Is your life focused on that which God counts as important or some man-made rule that you are picking about? Then he turns to them a second charge. You're not only doing that, you're also looking for the praise of men. You guys walk into the synagogue, I've watched you, he'll say. You want the best seat. You want the seat where everybody can see you. You want the front seat where you're in front of everybody else, the seat of position and power and prestige and all of those things. Or you go to the market and you make sure people can see you. In fact, sometimes you stop and you pray out loud so everybody can see how spiritual a man or woman you are. And he goes on and he says, why is it that you want the praise of men, not the praise of God? You ever found yourself doing that? I want people to like me rather than God to be pleased by me. Then he looks at him a third time and he says, on top of that, he says, you are guys like people walking over graves. Now, this is a picture that you have to understand in the culture of that time. Most graves were little tombs that they would hollow out, and they were multiple used, and so if a person died, they would take them to this cave kind of thing. They would put them in there into a box, and they would allow the flesh and everything to rot and all of those kind of things. And then once the flesh was all gone, they would take the bones and put them into a pile in this place or that place. And then the next person to come, and they'd put them in the box, and they'd just keep reusing the box. Now, the reason the smell wasn't there is that these big stones were put in front of the grave, so that people wouldn't smell all this horrible rotting flesh. They would put grass out, and they'd maybe put flowers around it, and they'd plant trees around it. And if you would walk into this grave, oh, is this a really pretty place? Jesus says, you guys are like that. You have all your outside adornments. You dress really nice. Your hair is just perfect. Your speech is great. You carry and dress and talk so that everybody think, oh, is he ever a wonderful guy? Like, God clearly blessed him. And Jesus says, but you don't know what's inside their tomb. You don't know the putrid, smelling, rotten sin that's festering and festering and festering, because they have this outside image all prepared. He will later say, or previously he will say, he says, it's kind of like light in your coming into your body. He says, if you open your eyes, the light will come into your body, and you can see inside. If your eyes are closed, the light can't get in. He says, it's time to let the light inside for you to clean your house out. I paused and started to think about that. And I started to think, you know, those charges could come against us. Do you major on the minors, those things that are insignificant to God, and forget to do what God feels is really most important? Are you more interested that people shower you with praise or adoration or compliments or gifts or things than God does? Are you a person who keeps that outside image looking really good and haven't dealt with what's inside you? Now, these are pretty heavy words. And I think it's, Luke adds this, and I think it's almost hilarious he adds it, that in the back row, one of the scribes sit up, and he says, excuse me, do you know those words are kind of hurtful? You know, you're not treating us really well here, right? It's funny. It's almost, the Pharisees have always been the guys shooting the darts on everybody else. They've been always the one finding fault, always the one attacking, always the one going saying you haven't done this or you should have done that or those kind of things. I don't know if they've ever experienced this before, especially to the bluntness Jesus had. And Jesus kind of smiles. And he looks at this scribe, who was a teacher of the law, who was one of the guys who would write down these rules and make sure everyone was following the rules. And he turned to him and he says, and there's some things we need to talk about with you. And he lays out three more charges. The first is, you're burdening those people who are broken. The people are poor, the people are struggling, the people are trying to get through life, the people have health issues, they have financial issues, they have family issues, they're struggling, and all you do is load more rules on them and more regulations on them and more expectations on them and more demands on them, and you don't care about them at all. And I hold that against you. Secondly, he says, I have something else against you. I've watched you. I've watched you all over Jerusalem. You're building these monuments. Well, this monument is designed to remember the great prophet Isaiah. And this one is to remember the great prophet Jeremiah. And he says, I've watched you build these monuments to the prophets. I've also watched you run around and talk about how great your fathers were and your forefathers were and how great they were and godly they were and everything. Those fathers of yours were the ones who killed your prophets. And now in this bizarre contradiction, you're building the prophets' monuments, prophets who your fathers killed. He says, you hypocrites. And he lays a charge on them that I almost shudder when I hear. He says, when God comes, not only will your fathers pay the price for and come under judgment for that, you will come under the judgment for that, for you have joined in on their sin. All of the prophets that have died. It's interesting, he also makes an interesting comment because he talks about the prophets and the apostles that will die. The apostles were standing all right there. Of the 12, 11 would die as martyrs. And the religious leaders would be the ones attacking them. And so there's almost a prophetic nature to this as well, that not only have you killed the prophets, your fathers killed, you're going to join them by what you do the apostles. And so there's judgment coming on them. First of how you treat the people, and then how you have treated God's messengers, God's servants, God's anointed ones. But he says, that's not the worst. The worst is, you have been given the keys to the kingdom. What's that? The scriptures. These men intricately and intimately knew the scriptures backwards and forwards. Most of them had memorized the entire Old Testament by heart and could recite anything that you asked them to do. And he says, you know what you've done? You have been the keys to enter God's kingdom. And you have chosen not to walk through that door. But not only have you not chosen to walk through that door, you have taken that key and you have locked that door so the people can't enter the kingdom of God. When you think about that, that's even more terrible than the previous charge. It's interesting what happens when we listen to Jesus speak into our lives. For the choice is that I will hear what he says and I will apply it. I will deal with my sin. I will deal with my rebellion. I will deal with my rejection of his direction. Or I'll attack him. Something about the way he said it, or it doesn't relate to me. It has nothing to do with this time. And very many people will read through this passage and say, it doesn't have anything to do with me. You know what these Pharisees did? It says, the very end of the chapter, Jesus left the meal and they started putting their heads together. How are we going to get rid of this guy? He's just too dangerous. I stopped and I listened to that a little bit. For they had attacked him and he had graciously and simply defended himself in a way that didn't attack them. A way that showed them a light that they were refusing to see. And then they come after him again. And so he says, okay, it's time for you to hear it. And he tells them these things. And he looks at the Pharisees and he says, you major in minors. And you seek the praise of men. And you have the spiritual image, but on the inside, you're full of sin. And he turns to the scribes and he says to them, you put these burdens on God's people? You make it so hard for them to keep their faith? And then you live this contrary life that contradicts what you say. And on top of that, you keep people out of God's kingdom. And I was thinking about that as I started to think about that, and I started to say, is there a potential for us to refuse to listen to Jesus? It's a spiritual pride issue. I don't want to hear that. I don't want to listen to that. And they became hostile to Jesus. And Jesus has said, because of this, there will be a reckoning. Translated, there will come judgment on these Pharisees and scribes and leaders. Why? Because Jesus knows each person's heart. He knows your heart, and he knows my heart. As I prayed about that, I started to ask myself very simply, how do I see Jesus? How do I listen to Jesus? You know, we're in a culture that really emphasizes Jesus' love. Jesus' love. Jesus' love. That he has compassion for us, even though we're sinners. His empathy for us. He feels with us and he knows our struggles. And he cares for us. And all of that's true. But for balance, there's an invitation to say, he is also truth. There are times that he will say to you and to me hard things, rebukes. There are times he will challenge us, and the result is if we disobey, there's some justice or there's some consequences. He will be honest with you if you will listen and if you will respond. Jesus loves you. He also is speaking truth into your life even today. Would you bow in prayer with me? Heavenly Father, I would ask that this would just kind of percolate in us. We are a people who love to hear the good stuff. But there's other things that you want us to hear. You have come to move us from sin to salvation, from disobedience to obedience. From rejecting you to being called and transformed by you. I would ask that today you would work in each one's life and allow each one who listens, even this day, to hear you speak to them. For some, they need to hear words of encouragement and love. And for others, they need to hear practical words of truth. May we be a people who are willing to hear both. For that's the true Jesus. I would ask this in Jesus' name.